Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goals are to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's obstacles, challenges, and opportunities successfully. Our purpose is to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit. At this time in history, we desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual as well as at the collective level. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations with the movers and shapers who have created the new medicine and who are continuing to create holistic approaches to individual and collective healing. Along with this, you will receive practical tools and experiential guided imagery to help you embody the wisdom that our guest brings us. So once again, it's time to relax, focus your mind, and open your heart to the power within. Welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. Today's guest is Dr. Michael Finkelstein, who is a physician. He's known as the slow medicine doctor. He's been featured in top media outlets, including the New York Times, CNN, ABC. And he's presented at many venues, including Omega Institute, where he is a faculty member. And he blogs on the topic of slow medicine for the Huffington Post. He was educated at the University of Pennsylvania, where he received both his undergraduate degree as well as his medical degree. And he was awarded the honors of Phi Beta Kappa, summa cum laude, and he was on the dean's list. And then he went on to study at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, where he completed an associate fellowship in integrative medicine. They're studying with integrative medicine pioneer Andrew Weil. He is certified in both internal medicine and integrative holistic medicine. He is in private practice, but also serves as a medical director of several major hospitals and health institutes, including two integrative medicine hospital departments that he founded. And today, we're going to be talking about what Dr. Finkelstein calls slow medicine. So, welcome, Michael Finkelstein, to Conversations with Extraordinary People.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here and to share in this conversation with you.
Now, when I first saw the title of your book, it caught my eye right away in this world where everything is to be done faster, where physicians usually work for clinics and organizations that very carefully track how many patients they see in a day. And I've read studies where the average amount of time a physician spends with a patient is 8, 10, maybe 12 minutes at the most. And you can even get fired for spending too much time with patients. And yet, you talk about slow medicine when the world is really looking at fast medicine. What do you mean by slow medicine?
Well, I think you hit on several of the reasons why I thought to provide a provocative title to the work. As it turns out, though, I'm not the originator of that phrase, and I don't want to take credit for it.
Yeah.
It emanated in Italy, much the way slow food emanated in Italy, in response to what I might call the Western virus, the North American virus. When fast food entered Florence, there was an uprise, and slow food was the result. Other individuals, specifically physicians in Italy, also saw the fast medicine undermining the quality of care and even the role and the lives of the physicians who were practicing medicine, and taking from their colleagues in the food industry, said there should be a slow medicine counterpart and an option for people and a movement that would help ultimately change the balance and pace and approach to health and healing. That movement is very well known, I think, in Italy, but not so well known in the United States. And as it, in truth, I never heard of it when I came up with it. So I was just thinking along the same lines, you know, that if there's fast food responses, slow food, and I heard of slow money also as an institution, I said, why not slow medicine? And, of course, then after you do something like that, you do a search on Google and you realize that you're not so original. But the fact is that, you know, you hit on the point that there is this tendency when it comes to many of things in our lives, in our culture, to look for the most immediate solution. And occasionally that does work. Sometimes, you know, if you call AAA and you get your tire fixed on the side of the road, and if it's done in 20 minutes, you're really happy. Some things lend themselves to that type of approach. Acute medical emergencies also lend themselves to that type of approach. But for the chronic conditions that we experience in life, and I'm not just talking about chronic illness, I'm talking about just the experience of living and the challenges that it includes, a fast approach, we know this, does not necessarily work. In fact, ideally we would like our lives to be long and slow. So to offer a fast response to something that we want to take its time is antithetical. And so slow medicine really offers a number of different things at the same time. One is it sort of makes that point. But the other, it does suggest that when we think of health and healing, let's say we do have an ailment, that sometimes the most appropriate response is a methodical, rhythmic, cyclical, nature-oriented, cyclical approach that uses the physiological processes, the biological hardwiring that, you know, we are part, you know, sort of a part of the natural world and have just like anything else, and take advantage of that by not overriding those systems, but by using them at their best. And there's a rhythm for that, and it tends to be a lot slower than the typical.
So let's talk a little more about your perspective on life and health and healing and medicine. You've written, everything is interdependent, muscles and nerves, bodies and minds, people and planet. And each connecting thread has a domino effect on the other. To achieve and sustain optimal health, we need a perspective that goes beyond the obvious symptoms. And tell us a little more about the kind of perspective that you try to teach people.
You know, I learned this from recognizing that when I was trained in medical school to, drill down toward a diagnosis, and then once you find it and establish it, you look in your book for the treatment and the protocols, and that should be no more complicated than that. To realize that that doesn't always work, and that there are more variables than we often would like to accept, and therefore the complexity of human health is extraordinary, and therefore the simple approaches that we would love often fail us. Stepping back from that, with that experience, then I said, well, you know, how many variables are we talking about here? And then as you list them and you think of just the Krebs cycle, which is posted on the side of the wall of a ninth grade biology class, you realize in each and every cell these hundreds, if not thousands, of processes are going on simultaneously. That's just one cell, and we got a couple of trillion of those. And then you've got all the organs working together, and then you know you're related to your friends and family and your neighbors and your coworkers, and then actually the entire populace of the planet, not to mention all the animals and the, you know, geological and historical formations, and then the celestial. You realize that the number of variables is infinite nearly, and that to think that we could actually control them is specious as an argument. And therefore, stepping further back, my idea was like taking the mindset of a surfer. Well, we've got to ride this wave. We can't control the wave. We've just got to ride it. And we've got to learn how to stay balanced on top of it is maybe the best we can do. And if we can do that and at the same time find joy in the process, then that to me is what health looks like. And it's not to say that we won't get crashed upon once in a while, that there will be a real disruption in the beauty of the whole thing. But then the secondary question is, then how can I learn from my experiences so that the next wave that comes around I could stay on top of? As you keep going further back, I really believe if we look at our health from the individual perspective alone, we also will get stuck. We will all realize that at some point we'll fail. Our body will fail and we will die. And, you know, if we don't really have a strong belief or an understanding of what happens after life, we could assume that that's all there is. And, you know, it's hard to say that life has much of a point if that's the truth. Many people, I think, believe that there's something that transcends all of this, which gets you to the whole idea of other dimensions and other layers of existence and to the purpose of human consciousness to begin with. And that consciousness is largely informed by the experience of the individual. And so I sort of see a collective conscious evolution operating at the same time. And so all this is to say that our personal health challenges are opportunities for us to join a chorus of other singers to create the most beautiful music possible that has up to now not been created.
It's great. I love listening to you use so many of the same analogies that I do, and yet we've never met. It's pretty amazing. Well, let's try this one. Something that I worked with for a period of about probably 10 or 15 years before I came to a satisfactory description for myself. What's your definition of health?
You know, health to me is a state of being that encompasses everything. And so the state of being includes the individual's awareness of their state of being, but also its combination with everything around that exists. And so it's a relational experience. Health, from the Anglo-Saxon root word helen, means whole. And to me, health is not the absence of disease or, you know, whether you live to be 99 or 110. It's the quality of your experience and the meaning of your existence as it relates to the whole of creation. And I think that broader definition of health allows individuals, no matter what's going on with their physical body, to contribute. And in so doing, have a meaningful life, which to me is the point. So the purpose of health is to have a meaningful life. And that doesn't mean the absence of disease. It means to be healthy means to live a meaningful life.
So that being aware of one's own values and purpose in life are very important.
Yes, I think essential. They're the essential. Now, you know, when people are stricken with diseases, especially those that produce a lot of pain, whether that's physical pain or psycho-emotional pain, they often can't imagine how they can contribute to others. They get so caught up, if not preoccupied, distracted by their agony, that it's very hard to step back at times in our lives, and maybe all of us at one point or another have experiences, though not necessarily such profound depth of things like depression and pain. But we can relate and understand if it got so loud, it could be almost impossible to accept and buy into what I've stated. However, we all, I think, want to have something to live for and to find meaningful. And ultimately, if we didn't have so many negative messages thrown at us from the beginning of our lives on, We might believe that each of us is embodied with special gifts, unique talent, and the ability to contribute. And I think sometimes finding health is finding your way back to that understanding of self.
And so give us a, if you're practicing slow medicine, what would that look like with a typical person that shows up and says, I have a problem?
Well, the first thing, you know, I offer is time. You know, I say to people when I see them that, you know, your visit with me could be as long as 2 or 3 hours. And I say that intentionally because I want to make it clear that I'm not rushing people from the beginning and that they're going to have time to ask all their questions and they're going to have time for me to really get to know them. And before I see them, I ask them to complete a thought-out intake form questionnaire, which is about 25 pages long, takes most people about an hour, which basically tells me their story from birth to now, what they do, what they think, what they've experienced. It's not, maybe it has one or two pages of, that are similar to most physicians' questionnaires about their physical body and blood tests and things like that, but the other 20-something pages are about their experience of life, things they enjoy, things that, you know, they resist, relationships. It's along the lines of saying, I'm going to help you do a jigsaw puzzle, and the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to, with you, take every piece out of the box. And I'm going to put that on the table. And so I try to identify a lot of pieces that people often do not put together in one sitting. Once there, and actually the process itself is very informative for people. It helps them really begin to see themselves and begin to see their story, including a lot of things that they like about themselves, their unique nature, their thoughts and ideas, their interests in other people. And when I do that, of course, then I superimpose their chief complaint. And I say, okay, so now, though, you're here to see me because you have this unrelenting pain. And you want to know what I can offer you to help relieve that. And I say, you know, I tend to ask a lot of questions, as you're probably garnering. The original title of my book was called 77 Questions for Skillful Living. It's been changed to Slow Medicine for a reason because 77 seems daunting. But what I do often is ask people sort of in a Socratic method so that they can see things for themselves. Because I do believe if somebody comes up with their own answer, it's actually a lot better than me just simply providing them a prescription. But I do help them. And I help them by asking some very good questions. And one of the questions I ask them, I actually ask them to envision in the future. I say, let's say I happen to have been a magician, you know, they came to the right person. I actually have a magic wand, and I could wipe away all their symptoms right now. I could restore them to perfect health, whatever they would define as perfect health. I then ask them a question, now what would you do with your life? And with that question, we begin a conversation to help them figure out how they get back to that passion and purpose, and how their current symptom is now put into a context of those things that have interfered with that progress or their ability to function at that level. Not to be better at their job or even better in their house, but what's their true purpose? What would they do with their life? And with that as a ultimate goal, everything else is put into sort of relative perspective. And so I share that with them. I then make the point to say, what I might tell you and what others have told you in the past as far as specific ideas for remedies and therapies, like even if they're holistic and, you know, nutritionally based, supplements, non-toxic things, behaviors, practice, to me they're all seeds. They're all good ideas with potential, and sometimes we know they can be very powerful. And when they're done together in the right formula, they can be really remarkable. But they're seeds, and they got to get planted in soil. And so the soil is you. It's the whole amalgamation of your experience and your being. So how can we improve the quality of your soil to receive those seeds? Before I start telling them my thoughts on diet, before I start reviewing my ideas for supplements and complementary therapies and even Western medicine if that's important, I want to know what we can do to improve the quality of their soil. And the best thing people can do to the quality of their soil is to think about flow. The reason I say that is because we're living, especially when we're in pain and we're distressed, in a state I would call sympathetic overdrive, where fight or flight is dominant and our adrenal glands are pumping out stress hormones and neurotransmitters that are, you know, basically keeping us in a state of fear and anxiety most of the time. It's not only our own lives, but we're watching the news and we're hearing about other people all over the place, and we're inundated by more than we're really meant to handle. Yet we are, and we're caring individuals, so we sort of care about it, but we don't necessarily have the capacity to do it. Yet our body responds as if we are being chased. With that tenor, that background of sympathetic, those seeds don't go very well. It's like having soil that's too hot. So we need to cool off, we need to slow down, and we need to prime the parasympathetic pump, the corollary component of the autonomic nervous system that's also built in, but is described by a rhythmic, slow-paced, fluid, balanced nature. And to do that, one needs to essentially restore balance in as many areas as possible, including day-night cycles, rhythmic cycles of the seasons and the week and month, alignment with purpose and passion, the elimination of unnecessary baggage, whether that's stuff cluttering your closet or stuff cluttering your mind. It's all part of this revitalization of the soil. And then you take those three, sometimes the same seeds that have already been recommended and tried, now you're planting them into something where the potential for growth is even greater. That's what I call flow medicine.
Wow, that's wonderful. Yeah, and it really, what I finally, the simplest, you know, as a mathematician, you tend to get very, very simple. So what I finally came up with is that healing involves fundamentally two processes, the establishment of the identity. What is the identity of that which you're trying to heal? Is it a family? Is it a community? Is it a person? Is it all of the above? Or is it... the identity simply that you're able to get back to work. And then secondly, the process of balance, or the creation of homeostasis, of bringing that parasympathetic level into do its thing. And I like how you described it as that rhythmic and slow-paced and balanced nature. And say a little bit more about how you help people achieve that.
Well, so with those questionnaires, I sort of help them identify where they're in balance and maybe where they are potentially out of balance. And I give them ideas as to how to organize an approach that helps them restore balance. And sometimes it's obviously important not to start with the most difficult. Somebody might come into my office and they're smoking. And they may say, I have a desire to stop smoking. And, of course, we would all agree that's a good thing. If you tell many smokers to just stop, you know, a few can do that. Most can't. Most are unwilling for reasons that are clear. Is because they're dependent, not only physically, but maybe psycho-emotionally. And so before you decide to change in a behavior so abruptly, you need to make adjustments and maybe put together a supporting cast, if you will, of behaviors that will allow one to shift from a state of imbalance back toward the center. And so the first thing that I do is I help people really to see themselves. If you said to me you want to get from California to New York, well, then I would say, okay, you're in California, but California is a big state. Where in California are you? Because if you're in Northern California, that's one road, and if you're in Southern California, it's another road. And so the first thing I do, even though we may agree on the destination, is you got to know where you are. And that starts with somewhat of an inventory of where you are. And those questions that I ask, those 77 questions, then are part of that inventory. Where are you with your relationship to your family, to the divine, to children, to nature? Are you near or, you know, about your ideal body weight? Do you drink enough water? Do you move your bowels effortlessly? These are all inventories of how you are doing. And very few people are perfect, obviously, and most are actually far from it. But in every single question, there is some discussion that could help give people ideas about how they move closer to a state of balance. And if you do that, you tick them off one at a time, ultimately the synergy among them is pretty great, and one winds up in totality in a state of dynamic balance that did not exist before. Then they're stronger. Then their total anxiety level is less. Then they're actually sleeping better. Now they can stop smoking.
Mm-hmm. Really. And it's really, really treating the whole patient then.
And it's understanding, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally a quick fix works. I mean, occasionally. You have strep throat, you get an antibiotic,
yeah.
You're going to be fine. You know, it might actually create an imbalance in your intestinal bacteria. Well, that's a problem down the road, but most people actually will be fine. And so, but that's rarely what's happening when people come to see me. This is usually they've been to 10 other people, and they're frustrated, and they've tried many things, and they know they're working hard at it. And so that's why I use that analogy of seeds and soil, because yeah, they may have gotten the right seeds, but they're putting those seeds into soil that's still a little out of balance. And so a little shift in the physiology, if you will, of the soil. And that's not just the physical properties. And when it comes to humans, it includes their mental, emotional state and their connections on the levels of spirituality and planet and cosmos. And as I mentioned, I think even their ultimate destination, which is this cosmic higher collective consciousness. So all those relationships, I think, need to be brought into the conversation. Without overwhelming people, because this is not you have to be perfect. This is that you have to understand what it takes to grow a tomato. And you can't grow a tomato, in frigid cold weather. You just can't do it. So you've got to provide the right conditions.
And I think there that also applies to the situation that where that leads you to say to people what you say, which is put down the fork and feed your soul?
Yeah. Well, you know, food is a great subject. We're obligated to eat. And as I see it, almost all the conversation is about the food. What about the person who's consuming the food? So I know from my own experience, I could have the perfect food on my table because I go to a farmer's market and I buy this great stuff. I know every single farmer. But if I eat that food in a state of distress because I'm watching the 6 o'clock news or, you know, my neighbors are screaming at each other and I can hear that, then what am I doing in terms of digesting and assimilating those nutrients? And so I think what's on your mind when you eat is as important as what's on your plate. But I also think that there's a whole other discussion, which is that when we think of nourishment, there are other aspects of ourselves that require nourishment, and the physical body is just one. It's one of three, as I see it. The other two include our emotional nourishment and then our spiritual nourishment. And when somebody is emotionally or spiritually hungry, their brain doesn't necessarily know what that means. It just says hunger, 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 and we go for what's available. I think so much of the reason that there are, food behavior is such a problem is that we're used food, physical food, to feed all these other parts of hunger that we experience. And what we really need is connection to the natural world. We need healing from the traumas that we've experienced. And when we get to that state of balance, we'll be able to discriminate physical hunger from the other forms of hunger.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Now, would you let people know where they can learn more about you? Do you have a website and where they can gain access to your writings?
Sure. Easiest thing is slowmedicinedoctor.com, and doctor is spelled out with D-O-C-T-O-R. And I'm happy to receive emails, michael@slowmedicinedoctor.com. I have a pretty active presence on Facebook, and as you mentioned earlier, the Huffington Post has carried a lot of articles that I've written over the last several months. So a search of Dr. Michael Finkelstein and Slow Medicine Doctor on Huffington Post would find many of those.
Okay, great. And your practice is in Westchester, right near the city of New York?
It's about 50 miles outside the city of New York in a fairly bucolic setting. I live on and work on a small farm, which is a model for this balanced living. People come here not only to see me in consultation, but we have many programs, and it's where I live my life, which is to try to be a model of, for myself. I try to follow my own advice as much as possible. And I will tell you, I'm not perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, I just have a clear sense of, you know, what, you know, drives me and where, you know, and balance as the focus, and this desire to connect with people at the highest level possible, mm-hmm. to join with them, hold their hands, and together make beautiful music.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to remind everybody that you are listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, which is a publicly supported program. Remember to visit our multimedia website, drmiller.com, that's drmiller.com, and there you'll find my videos. You'll find archives of all of these conversations, and there are some fabulous ones. And you can tell people about this one, and it's right there, so you don't even have to be there at a certain time. And you'll find a plethora of information on mind-body medicine, self-healing, deep relaxation, and software for the mind, as well as our free e-newsletter and the regular free guided imagery and meditation gifts that you will receive if you sign up for the newsletter. You can support us by visiting our online store, which is at shopdrmiller.com. And there you'll find my audio and video programs, which feature self-applied deep relaxation, guided imagery, meditations for healing the body, balancing and invigorating your emotions, and overcoming bad habits, and for achieving peak performance. Learn to re-script your mind and rewire your brain. You can also support us by telling your friends, clients, patients, and those on your mailing list about what we have to offer. And join in the conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/AskDrMiller. So, back again to Dr. Finkelstein. You mentioned connecting with people at the highest level possible. Say a little more about what that means to you.
Well, you know, I can remember when I was a little boy thinking, like, about the universe and the meaning of life and why we're here and why do people suffer. And, you know, the best I could come up with, not just at that time, but through my whole life of pursuing that question, is what I want to believe, I guess, is that there is an ultimate purpose, that we're doing something here that's really meaningful, not just to our own lives and maybe even the generations that follow us, but to some sort of higher calling even. When I think of, let's say, the concept of a creator, some entity that put this all into motion, though I can't tell you that I'm 100% convinced that there has to be a creator, but let's assume that there is one, imagine that there is one, then what would a creator be doing by creating us? Is it just for entertainment, to just watch these little, you know, things crawling around and, you know, hurting each other and, you know, making some nice music, but then tearing down buildings and, you know, making a mess and cleaning it up? And I mean, that's entertaining if I was the creator, but I'm not sure it would really be meaningful to me. Unless I created entities that themselves had creative potential and that could create something I could not create by myself. And so I do believe that in some ways we are have remarkable creative potential, so that even if there is no creator, what we are doing and the forces of nature are to have us in a state of evolution, not just physical evolution, but this conscious evolution, where through our challenges, through pain, we get incredibly creative. And in that, we create wonders. Now, part of what we need to learn collectively is how to be less destructive in the process. However, I think that the ultimate meaning of life is that we get as creative as possible and be less destructive, and therefore we co-create and we look for beauty and we look for ways to relieve suffering, and that's what drives us. And so when I think of human disease and the condition of humanity, and the suffering that befalls us, I don't see it as sort of a finite goal, which is let's just get, you know, somebody cured of cancer. which is wonderful. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. But I want to see something beyond that. So when we do that, now what does that person do with his or her life?
Mm-hmm.
How does that person help all of us create more beauty? And so I always ask that question, what's the meaning of this? And when I look at that, and I look at other systems of medicine, Chinese medicine, Indian medicine, Native American medicine, they wrap that question of a person's pain and suffering into, well, what does it mean? In Chinese medicine, you know, the body is not just the anatomic parts. The lung is associated with the emotion of grief. The liver is associated with the emotion of anger. The kidney is associated with fear. And so they ask questions. They have lung disease. What are you grieving? Or if you have liver disease, what are you angry about? That's not to say that that's all that caused your condition, but part of your healing is to move beyond some of those emotional blockages, and that's how one achieves their high potential and ultimately contributes to substantial physical healing. So I see these questions as being the doorway to more complete healing, not just on the current physical level of our singular existence, but on this larger collective that goes on beyond us. And then I have hope to believe that our souls and our spirits live on so that one day we can really truly appreciate what all this hard work has led to.
Mm-hmm. Huh, excellent. Well, I can remember back in the 70s, and I was a militant agnostic. Yeah, I felt that, how could you believe in God? Well, can God create us? God can create anything, and God can do anything. Well, can he create a rock that's so heavy that he can't lift it? Huh? How about that? I mean, it just could not get through my head the kind of religious beliefs that people had. And everyone I met had a different God. And the Catholic God was telling people that if they even stepped foot into a Protestant church, that would be a sin on their soul and so forth. So I couldn't make any sense out of it. And I saw the wars that religions were creating. But on the other hand, to be an atheist and say, oh no, everything just happened by accident, well, that's, to me, that required even more faith than to believe that there was a creator that did it. But what really started to affect me is when I was working with people in my office, and most of the work I was doing at that time had to do with people changing their habit patterns, and I teach people how many of our illnesses you can treat by lowering the level of stress, learning to relax deeply, and to use imagery and visualization of what you wanted to achieve. And I began to notice that people who had something that they believed in that didn't make any difference if it was Moses or Jesus or Shango or Shiva. If they truly believed in that in some way, they were able to get much better results. It particularly came to a head with me in working with people who were smoking. And the people who believed in Jesus were able to stop smoking much more easily than the atheists I was seeing. And this particularly bothered me because I was a smoker. I'd sneak out back between patients and have my puffs on my cigarette, and I felt pretty crummy about it, but I couldn't pull it together. And I began to realize then that if people had something that they really believed in, that it gave them the ability to bring a certain kind of strength and healing ability forward. The little story that impressed me was a fable of two twin young men who lived in a little town out in a very primitive place, and the tribe every day would gather around the banyan tree in the center of town, and they would all pray to the great spirit of the great tree. And one of the brothers was very devout. He would pray every morning. The other one says, this is a bunch of nonsense. This is a tree you're praying to. And so it went for a long time. And one day both Both these boys were out walking on separate pathways, and wouldn't you know it, at exactly the same moment, a tiger jumps out of the bush and attacks both of them. And the one who was the one who prayed, the very devout one, as he sees this tiger coming toward them, he thinks in his mind, "Oh, great tree, give me strength to fight this tiger." And suddenly he feels this sense of strength that goes through him, and he's able to fight the tiger off. And the other one, when he sees the tiger coming in, he goes, "Oh, shit, a tiger." And he gets eaten because he doesn't have anything to call on. And I begin to see that there was a value to having something that you really believed in. And really the beginning of my major spiritual growth started at that point, because I began to believe in belief itself. And then gradually you begin to refine what it is that you do believe in, and pretty soon one tends to be taken to a quite a cosmic look at things, and you begin to realize that in fact you are connected to all the things around you. And life goes so much better. You have so much more success, so much more of an ability to heal yourself. So yeah. Helping people open to that side of themselves is truly an important piece of what we do, isn't it?
I agree. And I think people have a natural tendency to move in that direction. They resist it consciously while they have the luxury to resist, but most people in a foxhole would be praying. even many atheists and agnostics. And like you said, if they don't have something to pray towards, and they have this nihilistic view, or that it's all up to them, that's a pretty empty feeling. We want to believe that there's something that supports us at a higher level, because we recognize not only our mortality, but our relative weaknesses in some of these areas. And, you know, if we were the best and biggest and fastest, what could we say about the world? So, you know, we seek the knowledge and the experience of something greater than ourselves, and that's our natural tendency. And to resist it, to me, is everyone's personal choice. But collectively, I don't think we're resisting it. Now, I don't think we need to follow the dogma and the rigid dogma of institutions that tell us there's one way to do it. However, I think that you see through human history, as long as it's been recorded, people have been praying, and people are experiencing the divine in many different ways.
And something that's really closely related to that has to do with relationships. And yeah. The importance of our relationships. Speak to that.
Well, I say to people that, in fact, our relationships are the best barometer of health. What I mean by that is the quality of your relationships really reflects your state of health. And the relationships include the following. One is to the obvious, which is other people, particularly, let's say, your significant other, if you have one, or your family, like your children and your parents and your siblings, and then there's your friend and there's your community. There's the natural world you have a relationship to. Are you swimming upstream all the time? Are you fighting it? Are you resisting it? Are you trying to conquer it? Or are you living in flow? And then there's a relationship to the divine, the stuff that we maybe is immaterial, that we can't control, we don't have any hope for control, but how do we relate to the mystery? How do we relate to the unknown and to the vast greatness that we assume is out there? And then lastly, it's our relationship to self, which perhaps is the most important of all the relationships, which is how do we feel about all of them? And where's our place in this cosmic reality, which is both physical and non-physical? And I think you can look at that and you could say, gee, I'm doing well in some areas, not so well in others, and that's a pretty good place to dive in.
Yeah, I look at it from an information processing standpoint. We have these really three pieces of three perspectives or three fragments that the brain uses in thinking about things. And the first is, who am I? You know, what is my What is my identity? Who is the me? Am I a physical body here? Am I a body and a brain? Am I a collection of cells? Or am I a spiritual? Whatever. But who am I to start with? And secondly, so it's what's the nature of me? And the second is, what is the nature of the world that I live in? And the third one is, what is my relationship to that? And if you change any one of those variables, you get a profound difference in how the person experiences the world.
Yeah.
And then so much of what we want to do is to find people, help people find more healthy ways to think about themselves and the world and their relationship to it.
And that's part of, you know, what I try to establish with people when I say, you know, where are you? You know, what part of California do you live in? Well, so it's, you know, what's your place in this reality, and how do you even define the reality? Because it would, your past would be very different depending on where you recognize yourself to be at the moment. And similarly, in that regard, then the question about where you're going is relevant. Is it, you want to live to be 150? Is that really where you're going? Or is there someplace else, and who's the you that's going there to begin with? Is that question of me? And so let's assume that me is this soul spirit level thing, which is animating this body, but is the consciousness that really is what there is. What do you want to do with that one? Where is that going? That to me is the question. And how can I maybe make use of this body to get me there? And then when we think of that, we realize that we can't just raise the world around us and sort of deplete all the resources and any more than we can deplete our own body's resources, because our consciousness is housed in this great cosmic physical world.
Mm-hmm. That has a lot to do with doing unto others as they would have you do unto them.
Yeah. Well, we're not separate. So yeah. I often say people are, you know, our community of people on the planet, the entire 7 billion of us, are like single cells in a multicellular organism. And do you think it would be good if your heart cell said, gee, I'm the most important cell of this body, and I'm just going to just take over all the other cells? I could care less about the brain and the kidney and the liver. So never would happen. So, of course, we call those parasites, by the way, when we have a cell or something in our body that decides it's going to take over. Of course, parasites consume their host and then they're gone. So that's what we're doing right now if we think of just ourselves as separate. But when we think of ourselves as part of a cosmic reality where we're a single cell in that reality, then all of a sudden we start treating all life, all things, very differently.
And of course, if enough of us begin to do that, we begin to create a different kind of globalization than the sort of economic globalization that serves and plagues us these days.
Yeah, I mean, it's what would you do if we're actually all cooperating? That would be a very different world view than the competitive world view that's dominant right now.
Right. And if you... If you tune into the football game on Sunday or the basketball game or any game, and you find a team that really has been willing to respect and acknowledge each other's strength and to say, you know, our goal is to win as a team, it functions so much differently from one where people are fighting because I want to be the star, or, you know, come, you haven't thrown me the ball.
That's, and it's so much more inspirational when you see groups of people working together for a singular purpose, and their connection, their flow, their compassion and love is very different than when you see individuals, you know, playing alongside each other, but who really could care less about the collective. And it's a, those are the models. Those are the role models of behavior. And although sports, as you mentioned, as a metaphor, is, you know, maybe best considered entertainment, it does teach us other things about cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, you know, there are times when we may need to try to outrun something, but it does change our worldview and our approach. We're living in a state of technology now where if cooperation was the rule, nobody would have to starve. That's different than maybe what would have happened 5,000 years ago or before, or 10,000 years ago before agriculture. There might have been starvation. You know, in a little tribe, you know, with limited resources, not a lot of technology, it might have been, look, if I don't feed myself, I'm going to die and nobody will be left. And so, but we're not living in that world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We have, technology has advanced us. So why can't we take advantage of that where we don't have to play that competitive game any longer?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and so it's, one has such a different experience in seeing a healer or a physician or practitioner who practice from that point of view as opposed to really what you get when you walk into a sort of mainstream medical situation where people become their disease. I remember being in the emergency room one day. I think it was during my internship, and you know, the nurse says, okay, in room one we have an asthma, and room two is a possible appendicitis, and room three is a diabetic ketoacidosis. I said, oh, no patients. She just gave me a dirty look and walked away. Speak to that. You are not your disease.
Yeah, I think that's a very important subject, because people are often consumed in a way by identification with their struggle and the challenge. And I can understand where that comes from, because, you know, when the pain is great enough, you focus on it, and your, you know, entirety of consciousness may be wrapped around getting out of that level of pain. I sort of understand where that comes from. However, that is an entrapment. And the question is that the only alternative for people? And if I can help people find another path where they don't have to be defined by their disease, where they could sort of see it as a condition, it's true, and symptoms, which is true, that if one separates themselves from, in terms of identification, one can then see other opportunities in terms of how to resolve to return to a state of greater wholeness where they could restore their meaningful life, then that's what I am doing. You know, doctor, the word doctor means teacher in Latin. You know, and I didn't realize that right away. I was trained, as many of us were, to be a fix-it man. Somebody came to me with a problem, and I would fix it. And that was a very powerful role. I mean, my ego really loved that thing. So at the time, when I was young, that would be great if I had the tools to fix every problem just like that. But I realized that the mechanics of the body are not like the mechanics of the car. And, you know, there's a living being, as you pointed out, in that house that is experiencing something that's separate from what's going on in their body, as well as what's going on in their body. And if I could separate those two and guide them, then I return to that role of teacher. And I could help somebody transcend their physical body, because sometimes their physical body is not cooperating, and it's not going to cooperate. So can somebody still live their life and find meaning in that scenario? And what I found out, you know, the longer I did that, is not only does that actually happen, but the physical body likes that. Like, if you can get out of that mindset and that entrapment, you have a greater chance of healing that physical body than if you stay stuck in it. So it does help the physical body, but it's just a different path around the obstacle.
Mm-hmm. I just recently saw that this movie, The Theory of Everything, story
yeah.
of Stephen Hawking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was in college, and they told him you had 2 years to live.
Right.
Well, he's still with us, but you know, and he just really demonstrates, here's a person, he had his own way of looking at the world, and he stuck to it, and just that sort of strength of character, of seeing it happen so often, and even Unbroken, the movie that's just coming out, you hear the story of this guy who makes it through the most incredible suffering. And when he, you know, tells the story of how he made it through, you see the same indomitable, you know, she asked him, you know, did you ever really think about giving up? And he said, no. I mean, he didn't even stop to think. Of course not. You know, it's just, you know, you're always looking beyond. And so much of the world that we live in has us only looking at the superficial aspects of things, and that traps us. And so we buy the clothes, and what's that marketing slogan, you know, image is everything, and people begin to believe that. But if we don't know how to look beyond the superficial at what's deeper, then we fail to be able to marshal our greatest strengths.
Right. And, well, our greatest strength is what follows in alignment with our passion and purpose.
Yes.
And so that's why that question is what I ask people first. If I could wipe it all away, if you could just imagine for a minute, it's all gone, there's no obstacle. Now why are you here? What are you doing on this planet? What are you going to do with this life?
Exactly.
And that's, you know, that's a problematic question sometimes, because people don't really know. And so they get a little panicky, because I think they intuitively understand how important a question that is, and that if they don't really have a clear idea of passion and purpose, then they might be floundering. But it's not to say that it's not something that needs to be addressed immediately, but that's a good question to work on, and to use your dreams and your subconscious and unconscious mind to guide you, and teachers and healers, and read books so that you can get in touch with that, because ultimately, you don't have passion and purpose, you really are, you know, sort of disconnected from a source of great strength, great will, and great ability to not only recover in this life physical body, but to transcend it and to contribute to this whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we become so focused on the obstacle, and we're kind of waiting for the magic pill to come along and get rid of the obstacle. But we need to... It's so much better. Yeah, there's something there, but let's not look at it as an obstacle. To see it as a challenge, an exciting challenge. You know, how am I going to meet this challenge? And then you begin to see that it's an opportunity. We opened one of the first cancer centers back in the 1970s, and we could see that so often that people, after having dealt with cancer, you know, whether they eliminated it completely from their body, or even if they still had it in some form, I've heard so many people say having cancer was a gift.
Yeah.
And of course, the cancer wasn't a gift, but because they took that on as a challenge, what they learned by confronting it in that way, it turned out it was an opportunity. It sort of, you know, shattered that superficial lock on life that so many people tend to have. So let's say
other thing I just offer on that is people are very outcome oriented. Let's get rid of the cancer. If I only get to be, you know, get lose 10 pounds or 50 pounds, or, you know, then I'll feel better. And so, as opposed to the process. And if the process is focused on balance, like you're riding that wave, then it's when you're in that state of balance that you can start looking around and appreciating how amazing it is to be alive and what kind of beauty you're able to see. And sometimes it's only because of the challenge that you're forced to achieve that state of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's therefore there's that silver lining in the challenge. And as I said, it tends to be quite healing if you get to that balance point. That's putting your body in the best position. That's creating the fertility of your soil to be ultimately creative and to grow the beautiful flowers that you have in mind.
Wonderful. That's a perfect place for us to stop, because we're out of time. And you've been listening to Dr. Michael Finkelstein. And you can learn more about him and about his new book called Slow Medicine by going to slowmedicinedoctor.com. That's with the word doctor written all the way out. slowmedicinedoctor.com. Thank you so much for being with us here on Extraordinary People.
Thank you so much.
You can learn about how to slow down and practice your own slow medicine by going to shopdrmiller.com.
And as a special gift for you, when you check out, enter the promo code DREAM, D-R-E-A-M, in all lowercase letters, and you will get a 20% discount on any MP3 you order.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.